You are listening to Psychological Research Stories from the Methodology for Psychology podcast. This episode is titled Dr. Daniel DiCaro on Synergistic Effects of Voting and Enforcement on Internalized Motivation to Cooperate in a Resource Dilemma.
One of the things we don't need right now, and this is a concern I have about science right now, is we don't need uninspired researchers. We really need researchers to ask really difficult questions and think of novel ways to address those problems and those questions.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to Psychological Research Stories from the Methodology for Psychology podcast. For those who have never listened before, this is a project that is focused on helping individuals who are wanting to pursue and better understand research in the area of psychological science. And for Psychological Research Stories, we interview researchers about specific interesting journal articles as a way to be able to be exposed to some of the research that's being done within the field of psychology, but also to be able to learn from some of these individuals' examples. So for today's episode, I'm going to be sharing an interview that I did with Dr. Daniel DiCaro, and we'll go ahead and jump right into that. Okay, I now have the opportunity to be speaking with Dr. Daniel DiCaro. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start out by giving an introduction to who you are. So tell us about where you're from, where you gained your education, where you're at right now, and we can kind of go from there.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, I guess I would start by saying I consider myself to be an interdisciplinary social scientist. So you'll see that basically I picked up a lot of different fields and went a lot of different places for training throughout my career. Formally, my background is social cognition, which is a combination of social psychology and cognitive psychology. And where I started was at Western Kentucky University as an undergraduate, and I picked up a bachelor's in psychology and philosophy there, focusing mostly on what I guess I would say is political psychology and political philosophy. And then from there, I went to Miami University of Ohio to do my PhD in social cognition, focusing on judgment and decision making. And then after that, I went for 3 years to a research institute called the Vincent and Eleanor Ostrom Workshop in Political Theory and Policy Analysis. This was at Indiana University, and there I got training in political science and economics and environmental governance, which is the topic that we're basically going to be talking about today. And that's also where I did the study that we'll be talking about today. And then right now, I'm at University of Louisville, and I do teaching and research for the Department of Public and Urban Affairs and the Department of Psychology. And I'm also operating my social decision-making and sustainability lab. So that kind of tells you the whole background.
Yeah, very cool. A question that I like to ask everybody is, what got you interested in psychology or political psychology and social cognition? What got you interested in those kind of topics in the first place, and so much that you would pursue that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, like most social scientists, just a general interest in why people behave the way they do. But in particular, I got really interested in human government, basically all aspects of government and society, formal government and sort of informal social norms and that sort of thing. And in particular, you know, governments have a really big role to play in society. They help us manage a lot of large societal problems that affect everyone's everyday life all the way throughout the world, too. And in particular there, I got really interested in democracy. And it seems to me that there are a lot of ways that we could improve human government, potentially. So if you kind of look around, you can see that there are a lot of issues going on in society right now. We're yeah. having a lot of wars over natural resources. We're yeah. having resource scarcity. There's a lot of political unrest throughout the world. To me, that's a fundamental problem with our understanding of human government and how to make it work well. So I got really interested in trying to improve that, especially in terms of how do we involve the public in government and how do we create situations that let people in society figure out ways to solve important problems for themselves.
Very cool. And I think that's a great segue into the actual article that we're going to be discussing, which is titled Synergistic Effects of Voting and Enforcement on Internalized Motivation to Cooperate in a Resource Dilemma. And that was published in the Journal of Judgment and Decision Making. And for everybody listening, I would point you to the URL methodologyforpsychology.org/DeCaro. And that is spelled DeCaro. And that'll bring you up to the blog post where you'll be able to find a link to this article and you'll be able to dive in and read that for yourself. Let's go ahead and start out with an introduction to kind of the research that had been done prior to your study.
Okay, yeah. So this is a really interesting topic in the sense that it's one of the areas where there really has been a lot of research done on this. So you can trace back all the way back to ancient and medieval philosophy, where the major philosophers at the time were really debating what's the best forms of government that we can establish to handle really big societal problems. And we're still wrestling with those same issues today. We just research them in different fields in different ways. So one of my main entry points on this topic, which I would basically say is the topic of environmental decision making and cooperation in human government, was through the work of Elinor Ostrom. Elinor Ostrom had a background in political science and economics, and in 2009, she got the Nobel Prize in economics for studying how small communities will come together and solve resource dilemmas. So the basic idea here is there are a lot of really big issues in society where people need to come together to sort of put in time and effort and problem-solving ability to solve the problem. So one of these issues is what we'd call a common pool resource dilemma. So this is a situation where there's a shared resource that everybody wants access to, but if everybody accesses it and they don't work together in a way to sort of come to conservation agreements or limit their behaviors in using it, then they can quickly destroy the resource. There can be a lot of conflicts. And there's other situations where people need to come together to produce something. We'd call that a public good. So to give you some examples, you think about all the oil reserves throughout the world. Those are really limited resources. They're going to eventually run out. If nations don't manage those as well, we can deplete them very quickly. We get into wars over those things. It destabilizes the economy. So you can also think about situations like universal health care in the United States. You know, that's a really contentious issue in the sense that we need taxpayers and political support to support those laws and provide for people that need help in getting health care. And then you can think of situations like in California, for example. They're having water scarcity issues there because of droughts and climate change. And there are neighborhoods there that rely on these limited lakes and reservoirs that if they don't manage as a neighborhood their water use well, so maybe limit how long they take their showers, they don't water their lawns and that sort of stuff, they will destroy that resource and can really affect people's lives. So that's sort of the background problem. And what Elinor Ostrom has done is to look at the major way that this debate has sort of worked out. So traditionally, there's been like a balance of two different perspectives. One perspective is the belief that regular citizens can't go in and solve these problems themselves. They're too big, people are too selfish, they're not educated well enough to solve it. And so there, the theory is that the government, the formal government, would have to come in, establish rules, enforce those rules, and there'd be very limited participation, or some participation, but not a whole lot. Versus this other perspective that no, government can set up ground conditions that can let people help solve the problem. So you've got kind of this battle between this. And what Elinor Ostrom did was she compiled a lot of the research that was already existing, case studies. And then she went around the world and visited actual communities that were doing a really good job solving these types of problems themselves, sometimes for hundreds of years. And she looked at how they did it. And what she found was that they would often use these certain principles that she called design principles. And one of them was participatory decision making, which is an aspect of democracy. And it was that the people being affected by the conservation agreements and other government systems, how much do they get to participate in designing those systems? And another one was, how is enforcement handled? Is it being enforced from the outside, or are they helping enforce it themselves? And the list goes on. So you've got that research there, and she got the Nobel Prize for showing that, okay, citizens can actually solve these problems themselves, sometimes even better than government, and wanted to understand how it was. So that's the basic background there, and I've been really trying to understand sort of the psychology involved there. And then there are some other aspects of this in particular, like I mentioned participation. Well, the key problem we have here is there's been a lot of research on this in laboratories in the field, and what you see is that sometimes allowing people to participate in making decisions, like voting, for example, sometimes it works really well, and other times it actually can make the problem worse. And the same thing for enforcement. So we have sort of these confusing mixed results of when are these design principles going to help, when are they not? And that's sort of, I guess, the general background of this.
Yeah, that's perfect. So let's go straight into your study and your design and what you did.
Yeah, so I should clarify, you know, I did this research with some collaborators. So one of them is Marco Janssen. He really has a background in economics and sort of helped me set up the environment that we put people in. And then I also collaborated with Alan Lee. Both of these people are at Arizona State University. And he was the computer programmer that really helped us establish the software we needed. And then we also did this work with Eleanor Ostrom. She was sort of my advisor while I was at the research institute. So the way we set up this study was we had some general hypotheses we wanted to get at. And the first thing was, like I said, what are the psychological processes involved when people try to cooperate in these dilemmas? Why is it that sometimes participation and voting will help? And how come it will sometimes hurt? And the same thing for enforcement. So what we did is we set up a research design that would kind of place people in a resource dilemma situation where they need to cooperate, but they're tempted not to, and then give them different opportunities like voting and enforcement and see how it kind of affects their behavior. So the way that we set up the resource dilemma was through this task called the foraging task that Marco Janssen has really worked a lot with. So if you can imagine this, you've got a whole bunch of undergraduates that come into a laboratory setting in a computer room. And what they're going to do for their task is they're going to be essentially placed on the computer, almost like a video game like Pac-Man. So imagine that you've got four people, they're on a field, like a football field, and there are these tokens out there. And the tokens, they're going to run around picking up these tokens throughout the experiment. And each of those tokens is worth real money, and they're actually worth 2 cents a piece. And as they pick those up, that's going to determine how much earnings they're going to get at the end of the experiment. And actually, if they do a good job, everyone in the group can come out of that, it's about an hour and a half, with about $25. Now, if they don't do a great job, they can actually collect the tokens, use them all up, and they'll come out with less money. And in some cases, people come out with like $8 or less, depending on their behavior. So these tokens are growing in this field, and they're running around picking these things up like they're foraging for plants. And we actually programmed these tokens to mimic the way that plants would grow. So in the beginning of a round, there would be a random distribution of these tokens on the field that represent plants. And they're clustered in different amounts of density. If you leave them alone, they will grow very quickly and make more plants, and plants that are far apart will grow more slowly. So the challenge for the participants is to figure out how to share that resource and not harvest it so quickly that they destroy it. So that sets up this sort of dilemma. Can they learn to cooperate around this, come up with conservation agreements, and stick to those agreements so that they can maintain the resource longer and get more money and let the resource thrive. So that's the basic task.
And is this something that the participants would be aware of, that like were you explaining that they're going to be growing, the coins would grow in these kind of ways, or is that just something they're seeing?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So what we do is we explain pretty directly how the resource will work. So we explain that, you know, we're going to put you in this playing area and they get some practice rounds. And we say, you know, these are going to grow at a particular rate. They're going to grow faster when they're clustered together. They're going to grow faster when there are more plants out on the playing field. We run them through different scenarios so they can kind of see how quickly they can destroy the resource versus not. But we don't tell them, you know, a goal. We don't say you have to work together or anything like that. We just tell them, here's how this environment operates.
Perfect. Yeah.
So that sets up the basic task, and we want them to have all that information so that it's clear that they're making educated decisions the best that they can. And that's really important from an economic science perspective. So that's the basic task. They'll do these for 4-minute periods, and they'll do it for a number of rounds. So they want to try to sustain this resource for up to 4 minutes at a time. So then we also broke the experiment down into 3 phases. At the beginning of the experiment, we had baseline conditions where the participants are just basically thrown into this environment. They can't vote. There are no rules. There's no enforcement mechanisms. And we just see what they do. Traditionally, what happens there is when they can't communicate, they can't work together very well, they destroy the resource really quickly. Then we threw them into a second phase where now we introduce the opportunity to vote on rules and have enforcement of those rules. And then in the third phase, we took away the ability to enforce because we wanted to see, are there any long-term effects of having enforcement before versus not? Because one of the issues that you run into is that sometimes you will see that enforcement will help cooperation momentarily, and then when enforcement goes away, it can actually make cooperation even worse than it was before. And we're trying to understand why that is. So that's the basic layout. And then in terms of the conditions, when we reached that second phase, we had 4 different groups. Some groups were allowed to vote on conservation rules using a majority vote. And those rules were things like, okay, everybody wait for 1 minute. Don't harvest anything. Just wait for a minute and let the plants grow, and then we can harvest as much as we want. So that's a strategy that can let the plants grow more, and then it's easier to share them and there'll be more of them. Another one was what we'd call private property. So this is a situation where each player gets 1/4 of the playing field, like they get a corner of it, and that is their area and they can do whatever they want with it. So we had 5 of these rules and we let them vote on them anonymously through the computer, and then whatever rule was the one that most people chose in their group is what they ended up with. So that was the voting condition. And in that group, in that condition, they voted and then they just kept that rule for the rest of the experiment. In the second condition, we had a group that voted, but they also had the ability to enforce the rules. And the way that worked was at any time during the rounds that they were in that playing field, they could spend some of their money to take away double that money from another player. So the idea there was that they could do economic sanctions on each other. So this is very similar to things you would see in the real world. Communities come up with these sort of ideas, but we also do this at a national level. So if you think about, there's been a lot of talks about economic sanctions on Iran, for example. So we're trying to see how that works. So this group could vote and they could enforce the rules by penalizing each other, essentially placing fines on each other. And then the 2 other conditions were that we had 1 condition where they didn't get to vote on the rules. Instead, the experimenter imposed a rule on their group. So what we did is if 1 group got to vote and they voted to wait for 60 seconds, we said, okay, here's your rule. You're going to wait for 60 seconds. And we didn't give them an opportunity to decide whether or not they wanted to use that rule formally. And then our 4th condition, we imposed a rule and gave them enforcement. So what that allowed us to do was to say, okay, what is the effect of voting by itself? If you let people participate in the process, what does it do by itself? Then the other condition, what happens when they can also enforce? And then comparing that to situations where they really had no participatory say in the rules. So it allows us to sort of tease apart these different aspects.
Yeah, great, great. Excellent. So tell us about what you found then.
When we went into this research, we came in with a lot of competing predictions. So sometimes when you do a study, you're like, this is the exact thing I expect to see. Well, in this case, we were looking at this from the perspective of political science, economics, social psychology, and some other fields like social justice research, and they had different predictions. So for example, if you look at social justice research and some of the research in social psychology, they would say things like, well, if you let people participate in making the rules, then what will happen is they will be more accepting of those rules, and therefore you will see better cooperation because they're going to comply with the rules and work well together. And then those same theories would sometimes say, well, if you have enforcement, it will actually decrease cooperation. So why would that be? Well, the core theory we were working out of was this notion that people have basic psychological needs that are really important to their motivation and their decision making. One of those is self-determination. So how much choice and free will do people have in their everyday lives and government? Another one of those is fairness of government processes. And so the psychological theory that I was just mentioning would say, well, if you let people make decisions for themselves, they feel self-determined, it seems like a fairer process, and therefore they'll be more accepting of the government and the subsequent rules, and that will lead them to voluntarily accept the rules, and then they will, and this is what we're talking about, intrinsic motivation or internalized motivation, they'll really see the purpose of those rules and they'll follow them voluntarily. So there you would predict that the voting condition would do really well, even without enforcement. Now, the same theories say, well, enforcement decreases self-determination and would be perceived as unfair because it's controlling you. So there you would predict that the voting and enforcement condition, where we had enforcement too, would do worse than the voting condition.
Yeah, so would that relate to like ideas of reactance and stuff like that?
Exactly. They might react against that in order to try to regain control. So you have these sort of competing predictions. And then there's also theories that say enforcement is the key thing. It's not entirely necessary to have a participatory process. So there you might predict that imposing the rule and having enforcement might work just as well as voting in enforcement, or perhaps better. So we set up these conditions to try to see, okay, which one of these plays out? And what we did was we measured people's perceptions of the situation and their motivations to see, you know, what might have actually occurred. So what we found was there were, I guess you could say, like three major categories of results. We have behaviorally, what did they do? Did they cooperate and work together and manage the resource well or not? And then we have some psychological phenomenon that helps us explain what they were perceiving and why they were behaving the way they were. And then after that, we had some follow-up analyses we did. So in terms of conserving the resource, what we found was that the voting condition where they could also enforce the rules did the best. They had a very big improvement in how long they sustained the resource over time and how much tokens they could collect over time too, so increase their earnings. So to give you an example, in the baseline rounds when there were no rules, what we found was that most of the groups would destroy the resource completely. It would just use it all up in about a minute and a half. And these are 4-minute rounds. So that means that they're sitting there for a long period of time with no resources whatsoever. Now, when we go to using voting enforcement, they were able to sustain that on average about an extra minute, which is pretty good. So the voting enforcement condition did really well. Then what you found was that the imposed enforce condition, where we imposed the exact same rules on another group and they can enforce, they showed no improvement initially with this. So that's kind of confusing in a way, because there you have this situation where enforcement is helping in one situation and it's doing nothing and perhaps hurting in another situation. And then what we found was that the vote condition, where they just voted and they didn't have the ability to enforce, did not do as well as voting and enforcement, but it did as well as the condition where we imposed the rules. So you're getting these perplexing findings that are really doing a great job of replicating what we actually see in field studies. So again, you've got the voting and enforcement condition did the best, followed by voting and then the imposed condition that were tied, and then voting, and then imposed and enforced was the worst. So the situation there is, why did this occur? So what we found was, looking at the psychological aspects of this, was voting on the rules in general made people feel more self-determined. They thought the process was more fair on average, and that did increase how much they accepted the rule. And then when you combine that with enforcement ability, it further increased their acceptance of the rule. So it didn't undermine their self-determination like we thought, up to a point. Okay, so there was a tricky aspect to this. So what we found was that if you look at the voting condition without enforcement, what happened is it was a majority vote. And in our groups, we had four people. Out of most of the groups, the rule one that won was only elected by two people. So you have a division in the voting. So you've got two winners of the vote and you've got two losers of the vote. On average, both of those types of people said, yes, the process was more fair as compared to when they didn't get to have a say in the rules. But then when you looked at acceptance of the rule, you saw that the people who won the vote, that got the rule they wanted, they accepted the rule really highly. And the people who lost the vote rejected the rule very strongly. It was actually worse than if they didn't even get to vote on it at all. So you've got this like fracturing effect. So if you look at the voting condition without enforcement, the ability to make people follow the rules, then what happens is the people who won the vote, they feel the process was fair, they got a really good rule that they accept, and they complied with it. The people who lost the vote rejected it and went around taking all the tokens, so they broke the rules. So on average, what you have is you have half the people conserving it and half the people destroying the resource. And that gave you a general improvement in overall conservation of the resource because it takes longer now to destroy the resource. Well, if you go and you look at the voting condition where they could also enforce the rules, what you find there is the people who lost the vote are now following the rules, even though they don't fully agree with it, because they're afraid of being punished. And we tracked their acceptance of the rule over time. And what we found is that after the second phase, when they've done a few rounds of this, over time, they're growing to accept the rule more and more. So what appears to be going on is that in the voting and enforcement condition, having an enforcement in place initially keeps the losing voters from disobeying the rules long enough for them to see how well the rule works, and then they grow to accept it, and then later on, they follow it voluntarily because they now agree with it. So that kind of helps explain why the voting and force condition did so well and did better than the voting condition by itself. And then in the last situation, the imposed and force condition that did the worst, what we found there was you impose this rule, half of the people thought, oh, that's a good rule, and roughly half of the other people thought, no, I don't like this rule. So those people didn't follow the rules. But when you introduced enforcement, it actually over time made it so that people essentially got more and more resentful towards the enforcement of that rule, so that over time they rejected the rule more and more. So you get this sort of opposite effect. It was actually pretty interesting because in the imposed enforced condition, the people who got the rule, that they initially followed it really well, and then over time they saw that enforcement wasn't effective, and they eventually gave up the rule themselves and started pillaging the resource too. And actually what we found was if you removed enforcement ability later on, so that was the third phase of the experiment, in the imposed enforced condition, compliance actually dropped by 20%. So as compared to the voting enforced condition, where when we removed enforcement, compliance only dropped by like 3%. Most people kept on following the rule. So you've got this situation where enforcement improved cooperation in one condition and undermined it in another condition. And psychologically, what we concluded about that was that in the voting and enforcement condition, when you vote, you feel, okay, this is a fair process. This supports my self-determination. I perceive this as a fairly legitimate or just form of government. And then when the enforcement comes in, the enforcement is justified. So if you think about this consciously, you would be, if you're the person that didn't like the rule, you'd be like, well, we did vote on this. It makes sense that they would want to enforce this rule. I'll go along with this for now. And then over time, you get convinced that the rule works. Well, in the imposed enforce condition, you've got an illegitimate process of forming that initial rule. So what happens there is an outside entity comes in and says, here's your rule. You must use this sort of thing. You don't feel self-determined about that. Now we give you the opportunity to enforce it among yourselves by punishing each other. It seems illegitimate. So you would go through things like consciously thinking, this is what we think they're thinking. Why are these people trying to enforce a rule on me that they didn't even want in the first place? So you perceive it as illegitimate. And actually what happens is it causes you to resent the rule even more. So that's the core finding.
Yeah, that's just so interesting. I'm reminded of some different work in moral psychology and political psychology and stuff. Like Jonathan Haidt in The Righteous Mind talks about the ring of Gyges, you know, and this idea of how do you kind of increase moral behavior, like this myth of this ring that can make you be invisible, and will people be moral if they have that? And I think like Philip Zimbardo also has, and lots of different people have worked that points in this direction, that one of this way that you kind of try to help guide behavior is by setting up structures in a way that makes people accountable and makes kind of that idea that anybody can be evil, anybody can be good, depending on different circumstances and such. And I think this research that you're doing is really interesting, because I think people are often thinking about enforcement, and especially when maybe in companies or any kind of problems that they're trying to resolve. And it's like, okay, well, we need to set up these kind of things and these ways to enforce and keep people accountable. But when people aren't necessarily involved, that it seems like that could be harmful to your actual goals of what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think you're exactly right. And actually a lot of this research talks about compliance and surveillance in organizational settings, for example. And I think you hit the nail on the head in the sense of that, you know, one way to think about this is, are people naturally inclined to do what's right, work together, conserve these resources, cooperate each other? Or do we need to have some interventions in place that help them bring out these better qualities? And I think, you know, my impression of the research is that it's a combination of these two things, that some people are inclined that they would cooperate without needing much assistance. We'd call these people pro-socials or sort of conditional cooperators. But a conditional cooperator is not enough. You need to also convince the people who would normally not want to cooperate. Maybe they don't agree with the rules. Maybe they don't agree with the governmental process right now. How do we do that? Well, we set up these conditions of surveillance, these different incentive systems. But the trick to it that I think this research points out is we got to be very careful in how we do that. We need to set up a situation where we can convince and compel people who would normally not want to cooperate, but also enhance their intrinsic, internalized acceptance of the rules. And so what I found in this research, which I think, you know, ties into what you're saying here, is if you put them in a situation where they don't get the opportunity to participate in designing the rules, it's not a democratic process in some way, and then you try to come as an outside entity and enforce those rules, then what you're doing there is you're not giving them a very good opportunity to think of internalized reasons why those rules might be useful. So they can't look to the government and say, well, they did use a fair process, therefore I'll accept it. And they also can't look to the other people and say, well, they're following it because they really believe in it. It's only because they're being forced to by these punishments. Whereas in the voting and enforced condition, they can look and say, well, some of the people voted for this rule. They must really believe in it. And it was a fair process. And then when you enforce it, actually the enforcement becomes empowering. It empowers the democratic process because it protects those agreements. So we came to this conclusion that one of the major principles here psychologically is that you need a combination of legitimacy, perceived legitimacy, and perceived security, which in economics it would call a credible threat of enforcement. But we think that you can't exert a credible threat of enforcement if you don't have legitimacy in place.
Very neat. And thank you so much for coming in and talking about this with me. Are there any other kinds of implications and questions that you would want to bring up before we go into the lightning round?
You know, I'm very interested in relating this back to real world settings.
Yeah.
So if you think about what's going on in the United States right now, and this is an area that I want to research a little bit more in the future. If you look at what's going on with political elections, for example, where we vote in presidents and things like that, especially with the presidential races, mm-hmm. they're coming down very close to the wire. So it'll be like a 50% versus, a 51% versus like a 49% split, where you've got 50% of the vote go 51% going to a Democratic candidate, and you've got like 40%, 49% going to a Republican candidate, for example. That's very similar to what was happening in this laboratory setting where you have a majority vote, where half of the group got the rule they wanted and half didn't. And that didn't work out super well.
Right.
Because
right.
what you had was that the people who essentially lost the vote thought this process isn't super fair. I don't accept the rule. And then they didn't work well together. And I think you see that playing out in our democracy right now at a large scale. And so I think one of the implications of this research is how can we set up different forms of democratic decision making that would decrease the number of people who feel like they're losers? If we can come to some system where they think the process is overall more fair in terms of the outcome of that process, then I think we will get better cooperation in society as a whole. So I think that's an important thing to look at. And then the other thing, implication that I think is important about this is, again, what we're doing here is we're replicating what we see in the field, where communities and small groups can often come together and solve important problems in society under the right conditions. And we're in a situation now where people have an even better capacity to do that. We have much better education in society. We now have social networking on Facebook and Twitter and things like that, where people can come together and organize and say, hey, I want to solve this problem in my neighborhood. So it could be a crime watch, neighborhood crime watch. It could be, let's manage this water resource that's in our neighborhood, or there's some pollution over here. So I think this research kind of helps think about how would you structure that. You would want a participatory process with some sort of enforcement in place internally that everyone thinks is fair.
No, so that is just so interesting. I think there's so many even more implications to this. So it's really great. Again, for everybody who's listening, go to methodologyforpsychology.org/DeCaro, DeCaro is how you spell it. And you'll be able to check out the article for yourself and read that. Wonderful. Let's go ahead and jump into the lightning round, if that's okay with you. And what this is, it's just simple little questions to kind of get to know you a little bit better, as well as to provide resources and suggestions for the audience. So the first question, if you could recommend any book to our audience, and it can be related to what we've been talking about so far, or really anything that you think would be valuable, what would that be?
That's a really good question. Yeah. I would say the first place to start is very classic, is Elinor Ostrom's book, Governing the Commons, published in 1990. That's where she really, she'd been working in this area for a long time, but that's where she really wrote her seminal work that a lot of people have been able to read and get good ideas from in terms of how do regular citizens come together in a grassroots way to solve really important societal problems. So that's a really good starting point. And she'll lay out in there the contrasting case which is really the dominant way that government works these days, which is this idea that the government has to come in and solve the problem. And so she sort of talks about how this sort of fits into that picture. So I would start there for the basic idea of cooperation in society and social dilemmas. And that'll get you started down her work. And I would also then look online. It's open access to everybody. Her Nobel Prize acceptance speech, she lays out her ideas there. It's a really interesting talk. Let's see. In terms of psychology, I would recommend, so this would be social psychology, I would recommend reading the work by self-determination theory. So this would be DC and Ryan. They've got a really good outlet online, self-determination theory research hub. They have all their publications. Most of them are open there for you to read. And what that'll do is help you get acquainted with this notion of how much autonomy do people want? How does that affect people's autonomy in terms of their motivation, especially in terms of this internalized motivation, how much people intrinsically accept rules and compliance situations? And then you can think about how those ideas relate to cooperation and social dilemmas. I think that would probably be a good starting point there.
Excellent. And if people are listening to this interview and they want to maybe look into your work a little bit more, maybe do you have a different article that they would start with?
Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of my work has originated in conceptualizing and synthesizing interdisciplinary perspectives on this topic. So a lot of my research is talking about public participation in environmental conservation in developing nations and in the United States. So you'll see me looking at a lot of case studies, laying out psychological theory for that. So if you wanted to get an introduction to that sort of perspective, sort of out of the laboratory, in the field, looking at real case studies, then I would go to a paper I published in Conservation Biology in 2008. And I did this with an ecologist collaborator, Michael Stokes. That would be a really good article to look at. It's about community-based conservation and autonomy-supportive environments.
Who are some researchers who have been influential on your approach?
Yeah, there's been a lot. Some of these I've worked directly with, and some of these are more like you're reading their works and you're really learning from what they have to say. So in terms of really influential on my thinking, definitely Eleanor Ostrom's work. Like I said, she's been influential in so many people's lives. She's very prolific. So from her, I really learned to think about this topic in its broadest sense, how the topic of cooperation around environmental dilemmas like this are very important to society. And she really influences sort of the background knowledge I have from like a political science and economics perspective. And she gave me the opportunity to do this experiment with her to really understand the psychological processes involved. So that was like a life transforming opportunity for me to work with her in that level. And she was also a really good role model in terms of, you know, living your life as a researcher. And she was super nice person, but also did excellent research that really transformed the world. So that was cool. In terms of conceptual sort of sources of inspiration for me, definitely self-determination theory that I mentioned earlier. You know, they do a lot of research examining this notion of when you put people into an environment where it's almost like government, but there's a power relationship where there's someone in charge and there's someone that needs to do something. So you can think of like a parent and a child, a teacher in a classroom with the children, a doctor and a patient. You've got political context, religious context, work context. So you've got the employer and the employee. They really help lay out the core theory of fundamental needs and how being in different kinds of environment, how much participation there is, how much enforcement is, might affect your fundamental needs and therefore affect your acceptance of the rules and then influence your behavior. So that has been really influential with me. I've studied self-determination theory for many, many years now. So I'm always thinking about the way that they would think about this. Although, according to my research, you know, they were off a little bit. Economic theory was correct in other situations. Other influential situations were when I was an undergraduate, I took a course in African wildlife management. And that course really started me down this trajectory. I was working in psychology at that point. I was thinking about self-determination theory. And in this class, I got introduced to this notion of community-based management of environmental resources. And I started to connect the dots and think, wow, a lot of these policies that work because they're giving people an opportunity to participate. And then I started to think about the psychology involved, and I started to work with this instructor who was Michael Stokes, and then we wrote the conservation biology paper. And then after that, I just continued down the road. So I'd say those are the three major influences on this area of research. And then I've picked up a lot more. I've been really lucky to work with a lot of people from different fields in law. I've been working with people in ecology, sociology, all sorts of places.
What's one of your favorite aspects of science?
This, you know, I teach a course in psychological statistics, analyzing data, which a lot of people would say, man, that is a really boring topic. Yeah. And students often dread it, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the first thing they say. Can't see how this would be useful. And often instructors dread it, but I love to teach it. And the reason I love to teach it is the reason that I get excited about science. You know, I'm not going to be the type of explorer that's going to go to the moon in a spaceship. But what I can do is I can think about human behavior and I can study questions about human behavior in ways that nobody else has ever done. And I can explore things about human behavior and society. And it's like you're going to a new world, you know? So I love that aspect of science, is to be able to see something that no one else has seen, and then also use that information to hopefully help improve the human condition.
If you couldn't be a psychologist or researcher, what would you want to be?
That's interesting. I've always wanted to go into science. Even when I was a little kid, like 6 years old, I wrote to the University of Kentucky saying I wanted to be a robotic engineer. I didn't go that route, but I think what I would do, I teach a lot of students in urban and public affairs who are going to be, who work in government, actual government, or they're practitioners, they're like community organizers, that sort of thing. I think I would actually go to the applied side of things. I would try to be some sort of community leader or go to the government side of things, I think, to try to enact change. I may take that route later on as I get further in my career, start getting that more and more.
Yeah.
Other than that, I might do cooking. I like to cook a lot.
Perfect. For the last question, what is some advice that you would give for individuals who are starting out, who are new or young researchers who are wanting to pursue academia and who are wanting to pursue this path? What's some advice that you would give? Another way I've asked the question is, what kind of advice would you give yourself? like if you could give yourself advice before you started graduate school and started, what would that be?
That's a really great question. My advice would be to get a question. Get something that in your life you absolutely want to know the answer to that question, and that has really important personal or societal significance. So for me, it was, I see a lot of problems in democracy, including people in their own government and the way that government manages environmental issues and other issues. So for me, I needed to know and still need to know the answer to how can we improve the participatory process? Why do these things sometimes work? Why don't they? If you get that question, you will be extremely motivated, and that is essential. So for me, it's not about intelligence of the graduate candidate or the person that's seeking an academic career. Everybody that's going to do that has the capacity to do it. It's the motivation. You've got to be really motivated to work those long hours, to really struggle with something and be confused and work through it and figure that out. So you need to have that question. And then if you have that question in mind, in terms of, in addition to motivation, it will inform what you go and learn after that. Okay. So you get this problem focus and you say, okay, well, I need to understand something about psychology in order to answer this question. But I also need to know something about environmental management and law and political science. And so it'll guide you to think about the right question, pose the right research sort of approach, and get the right education for that. One of the things we don't need right now, and this is a concern I have about science right now, is we don't need uninspired researchers. We really need researchers to ask really difficult questions and think of novel ways to address those problems and those questions. And to do that, you've got to be really motivated to learn and to think through the process. So that would be my main advice there. And then the other advice to that is read the classic works in that area to really understand the fundamental issues. Often they do a really good job, better than the newer research out there, I think, of saying, here's the fundamental issue. Read that, really know all those positions, and then come up with your own idea. Like, try to synthesize it, try to do something that really puts it all together and adds value.
Excellent. Dr. Daniel DiCaro, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right. So I want to thank Dr. Daniel DiCaro again for coming on and speaking to us about his research. And thank you so much for listening to the podcast. So I'll just leave you with that, and I will see you in the next episode.